Welcome to the UP Notable Books Club, brought to you by the Upper Peninsula Publisher and Authors Association. Greg Lusk, a native Uper who grew up in Lower Michigan and Southern California, has two grown sons and now lives in Hancock, Michigan with his wife, Sandra. He spent the long, dry summer of 1976 helping to suppress the largest, most costly forest fire that had burned in Michigan since 1908. He left his job as a fire specialist for the Michigan Department of Natural Resources to become the assistant fire boss for the state's suppression of the Seney Fire. As such, Lusk would need to call on both his experience as a seasoned veteran of Vietnam, as a platoon leader, as well as his degree in forestry from Michigan Tech to succeed.
And welcome one and all. It's nice to see familiar faces. I see Lori over there and Sue's coming and Mary and all kinds of people. And we've also got a lot of new people tonight, which is just great. How many of you have had a chance to get a copy of tonight's book and read it? Okay, we've got a few. I'm 17 pages away from the end. I started it yesterday, so I'm getting there. But and Julie here's read it, so very neat, very interesting. During the time of this fire, I was only 3 years old, so I don't remember much. So I'm glad Greg's here to help us. And it's going to be a nice talk. He's got a wonderful PowerPoint he's going to share with us soon. But first, I'm going to turn it over to Victor, because Victor likes to tell us UPA happenings. And as all of you know, we pay our authors for doing these talks. It's not a lot of money, but they get some. And that fee that they get is shared between the Crystal Falls Library and UPA. So, Victor, tell us what's coming up.
Thank you, Evelyn. And for those of you who don't know me, I'm the current president of the Upper Peninsula Publishers and Authors Association, UPA for short. And what I'm holding up in front of me is this year's copy of the UP Reader. It's important right now because the deadline for submitting your work to the UP Reader is going to be November 10th. Now, who can submit to work to the UP Reader? Anyone who joins us as a member at uppaa.org. That's www.uppaa.org. You can click on join, and for $40 a year, you become a member. You get to attend our annual conference, which is coming up on May 17th, 2025. You get the ability to submit your work to UP Reader. This UP Reader is the biggest one ever. It's 190 pages, more than 55 writers. Whatever you write poetry, memoir, we have all kinds of stories in here, people, true stories and fiction. It's a wonderful publication. This will be our ninth year coming up when we release UP Reader number 9 in April 2025. So that's really exciting. And now I want to share something very special that just came across my desk today. Hit the share screen button here. So, Joe Heskey is from the St. Ignace area. He's now a very important educator at the University of Austin down in Texas. He comes back once a year to the UP to teach his workshop, Development of a Novel from the Fearless Standpoint. Now, that's October 3rd through 5th in Hessel, Michigan, which is 45 miles east of the bridge in the UP. And what's important is they have just opened up a half-off discount, but only for members of UPA. So you can join UPA today for $40 and sign up and get this $300 workshop for only $150. So it's the deal of a lifetime. Everyone who's taken the Joe Heskey workshop says it's completely changed the way that they write fiction. And I've seen the results myself. It's really impressive. So if you're interested in the development of a novel from the Fearless Standpoint, you want to be a fearless writer, come join UPA and we'll hook you up with that half off workshop fee. That's all I have for today. Thank you, Evelyn.
And thank you, Victor, for all of your updates and information and telling everybody about the UP Reader. I know it's one thing that goes out of our library a lot. People enjoy all the short stories and poetry and essays in there. And it is my pleasure now to introduce to you Mr. Greg Lusk, who is the author of The Great Saney Fire. And really a neat book, lots of history, lots of science, lots of just everything, and very applicable to what's going on today with all the trouble with wildfires. So take it away, Greg.
Okay, thank you. First, I want to thank the UP Notable Book Club, which is an exceptional partnership between the Crystal Falls Community District Library and UPA. And I strongly recommend UPA. I wouldn't have had as much success with my book as I've had without the assistance of UPA and being able to get mentoring, particularly from Victor, who helped me out a lot, pointing me in the right direction. So I strongly recommend UPA and membership in it. They welcome membership and participation from anybody who has a UP connection, interested in writing, publishing books, and in my case, especially those who might be a beginner. We're going to start in talking about what was going on in the world in 1976. There was considerable excitement going on in the United States. There was a bicentennial celebration going on. Michigan had a red, white, and blue license plate with stars and stripes commemorating it, if you might remember that from those days. 1976, 48 years ago. Other memorable events in 76 included the Concorde entering service. Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak started Apple. Nadia Comaneci scored the first perfect score in gymnastics. And NASA unveiled the space shuttle. In that year in November, Jimmy Carter defeated Gerald Ford and became president. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed the year at 1,004. The average cost of a new house was $43,000, and gas cost 59 cents a gallon. And your paycheck, if you had a good job, was $16,000 a year. For those that haven't read the book, the first part discusses natural history, fire history, fire weather, and the last part of the book talks mainly about post-fire changes, progress made, and the future. But the main part of the book is about Diary of the Fire, and that's what I'm going to concentrate on tonight. The Saney National Wildlife Refuge is located in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, and it's located between Shingleton and Saney and south of M28. The refuge has an area of 95,212 acres and contains the Saney Wilderness Area, the Strangmoor Bog Natural Landmark, and those are within the boundaries, as you can see on the map here. By the way, if you have questions, I would entertain them at any time, but if you hold them, I'll try to leave enough time at the end, about quarter till, even if I'm not done at that point, we'll open up to questions then if you want to wait. Strangmoor Bog, shown on the left side of this map here, is a continuous peat layer over a sand plain that was produced by deposition of glacial outwash during the last ice age, 14,000 or so years ago. The 1976 spring fire season, April and May, early June, was normal. We had normal rainfall, kind of an average fire season in the spring. But with the coming of summer, the Upper Peninsula entered a period of protracted summer drought. The rainfall deficit became extreme at Saney. From July 31st to September 13th, only about a half an inch of rain fell. So it was very, very dry. This is normally a swamp at the refuge that's covered with a couple of feet of water or so. So by the late summer of 76, the Eastern UP had a moisture deficiency of somewhere in the neighborhood of 9 to 12 inches of moisture. The water table had dropped by about a foot. Matted swamp and marsh vegetation and the underlying peat and muck was completely dried out. By the end of July 76, the fire danger had become extreme. Drought conditions were comparable or worse historically than those preceding the notorious Peshtigo, Hinckley, Lower Michigan, and Thumb fires during the late 1800s that burned millions of acres in the upper Midwest and caused thousands of deaths. Researchers at the refuge recently discovered that there was a history of large landscape fires in the refuge in 1754, 1791, 1864, 1891, 1910, and in 76 during late summer droughts. And this, of course, you could extrapolate, was probably extending well back into prehistory. They did this by checking using a technique called dendrochronology. So there's a long history of large landscape fires in the refuge. On July 30th, a lightning strike from a thunderstorm passing over the refuge ignited a fire in marsh grass in the north central portion of the refuge, designated officially as a wilderness area that's federally designated. By this map here, you can see this star here is the origin of the fire. It's right on the banks of the Walsh Ditch. This is M28 up here on the north end of this map, and the town of Seney is over here, M77 coming down here. One little side note that was interesting to me, at least, there's evidence of bog iron sheets of iron plate that forms in acidic muck soils and organic soils. And the origin of this fire was probably attracted by that bog iron, in my opinion. On August 1st, Michigan's DNR Fire Patrol aircraft spotted the fire shortly after noon and radioed its location to the Seney DNR Fire Station, who immediately reported it to the refuge manager, Jack Fry, at about 1 p.m. Manager Fry attempted on at least three occasions to walk into the fire, and the Michigan DNR was denied permission to enter the area using motorized equipment due to its status as a wilderness. Although the Michigan DNR recommended immediate control, Mr. Fry did not feel an emergency existed that posed threats to wilderness resources, human life, or property damage. The Michigan DNR continued their aerial surveillance of the fire during the next 10 days. Normally, this area that you see in this slide here is completely covered with water 3 feet deep. On August 2nd, Mike Paluta, the district fire supervisor in Newberry DNR, flew the area in late afternoon and estimated at 30 to 40 acres in size. Looking south, this is probably directly above M28. Looking south, the refuge staff again attempted to walk into the fire, this time from the south end of the fire, and they were able to get within about a mile of the fire, but travel again became impossible because of the rough terrain and the burned area. They estimated at that time was about 200 acres in size. On August 9th, Michigan DNR sends tracked vehicles to mark the state and federal property line and to gather intelligence on the area. Mike Paluta learned that the marsh and the fuels, the organic fuels, were extremely dry, and a very real fire potential existed, and a problem was going to be it had been caused by this large fire that had the ability to escape and get out of the bounds of the refuge unless it was extinguished. On August 11th, the fire was still about a half a mile from state land, with the largest spread occurring on the north side of the fire. Regional Fire Supervisor Albert Livingston flew the fire and estimated the size at that time to be about 15 acres in size. On August 12th, the DNR had contract bulldozers start towards the fire. That evening, Mike Paluta advised Manager Fry that to sustain the control effort, the refuge would have to provide support services and supplies such as gasoline, medical aid, etc. On August 13th, Fry tells Paluta that the state control effort is to be called off. Paluta advises Fry that under the circumstances, the DNR cannot further assist with the fire inside the refuge. On the 16th of August, the refuge, in contact with the Fish and Wildlife Service in Minneapolis, calls the Boise Interagency Fire Center, which is the acronym is BIFC, for advice and assistance. On the 18th of August, John Russell, arrives and takes over as the federal fire boss, coming out of the Boise Interagency Fire Center. He flew the area early in the morning and found that the nearest access for equipment was still 5 miles from the fire. August 19th, two contract bulldozers and two BIFC crews, a total of 40 firefighters, begin constructing a line on the southwest flank of the fire, aimed to prevent spread onto the Manistique River State Forest to the south. The Hiawatha National Forest sent a fire crew, and they arrived on the fire and began line location and tractor construction of the line on the west side of the Walsh Ditch to stop fire spread westward onto state land. So on August 19th, the fire is now exceeding 1,800 acres. The dot, right, the cross right here in the middle is the origin of the fire on Walsh Ditch. And Townesini is over here. Germfask is here. And Shingleton's off the map over here. August 21st, another 20-person fire crew from BIFC arrives. Two fire crews and two bulldozers continued building a fire line on the southwest flank of the fire. August 22nd, fire size was approximately 2,400 acres by the morning of the 22nd. An additional bulldozer was rented and started towards the fire. So in the maps that you're seeing here, the red part is the new part that's burned in the last 24-hour period or 48-hour period. The part that's black is the part that had already been burned in the last 2.5 weeks or so, 3 weeks. Then on August 23rd, whipped by strong northwest winds, warm temperatures, and very low humidity, the fire runs 9 miles to the southeast. And down here, you can see the border of the refuge, and this is state land to the south. So it came onto state land. It was exhibiting extreme fire behavior with a towering convection column. The fire runs and jumps over the partially completed fire line and goes over the refuge boundary onto state land and burns an estimated 6 sections of land that's about 4,000 acres. The DNR mobilizes equipment and manpower from every division and from all corners of the state. The state base camp is established at the Cookson Bridge crossing of the Manistique River. BIFC headquarters was notified of the fire breakout, and a decision was made to dispatch a Class 1 overhead team from BIFC. An overhead team is a management team with an incident commander, a line boss, and various staff planning and so forth that are the overhead to manage a large incident, a large fire. And there were 6 teams formed. This, I believe, was the first year that overhead teams were dispatched across the country from BIFC. By the end of the day, there were 35 pieces of large DNR equipment on the fire, including tractor plows, bulldozers, tankers, pumpers, and aircraft, being staffed by over 100 MDNR personnel. August 24th, the overhead team arrives from BIFC with Bob Weber as the fire boss and takes charge of the federal control effort. August 24th, the fire is now more than 20,000 acres and growing. DNR crews work to build containment lines on the south end of the fire nearest state land. The federal fire base camp was established adjacent to the state camp at Cookson Bridge. And you can see that the supplies were starting to roll in. BIFC supported both the federal and state crews, a massive logistical operation with supplies being measured by the ton. This aircraft is at the old Marquette County Airport, offloading supplies into semis to bring them to the fire at Sini. August 25th, DNR completes containment lines around the south end of the fire after 72 hours of nonstop work. The fire continues to grow on the north end. Governor Milliken declares a state emergency, which allows the Michigan National Guard to assist. 135 National Guard personnel eventually helped us on the fire, showing here the 107th Engineer Battalion and 1437th Engineer Company. There were 60 2.5-ton trucks on the fire at any one time. They put on over 100,000 miles hauling personnel and equipment to the fire. National Guard cooks made 65,000 meals, and after they arrived, there was very few complaints about the chow. The National Guard spent in the neighborhood of $7,000 a day feeding the firefighters. And you ate standing up here if you were a firefighter. The National Guard rebuilt three bridges and replaced damaged culverts to provide access to the fire. Any questions at this point? Anything? Nope. I'll keep rolling.
Yeah,
then.
I have a question.
Sure.
Yeah, I was wondering, I had heard that the bog or peat, and I'm not exactly sure what peat is, but does that burn underground? Could this have been growing underground without being visible for a time?
Absolutely. Peat is a form of an organic soil, meaning that it's fibrous, and normally it's got water in it, water content. So the water content would keep it from burning. But in this situation, where there was such a deficit of rainfall, the organic fuels, peat included, was available to burn. And it did burn down as deep as 8 feet in the ground, or maybe deeper at later on in the fire. And one terrible thing about it was you would get done putting out the fire, and then 2 weeks later, because it continued to dry out, that peat was available to burn again. Not the stuff that burned previously, but new peat was available because it dried out. So it could spread over, no matter if you had put a control line in front of it, it could still cause you a problem because of the dry conditions. So peat was a big the organic fuels in the swamp was a big problem. It was a huge problem. Okay, thanks for that question. That's good. So the massive buildup of federal forces brought the strength to 750 firefighters plus support personnel. Aerial water bombing capability, both fixed wing and helicopters, was brought in. There was over 20 aircraft eventually working on the fire. Additional logistical problems were solved by cooperation with other agencies and the private business sectors. Fuel supplies were purchased from local oil companies. Charter buses were used to haul firefighters to and from the fire from the fire camp. Clean drinking water was hauled in milk trucks at 1,000 gallons a load. The Schoolcraft County Road Commission helped with road and bridge repair and culvert emplacement. And of course, the fire departments came from around the UP to help. Mutual aid is extremely important between all agencies in the Upper Peninsula, and they really helped out on the fire. Here's some of them here. You probably can't see these small writing: Escanaba, Munising, Marquette, and even the in the bottom picture here, interesting, was the Sioux Line pumper crew protecting their wooden bridges. Kind of interesting. The Michigan State Police moved their command trailer into the fire base on August 26th. That is on the left side is Bill Rosinski. He's the state fire marshal at that time, 47 years ago. Michigan State Police coordinated emergencies and communications from their trailer. And they are also in charge of highway closures. We did close M28 a number of times. Anybody that was around during that time may have been having to take a long detour to get around the fire area. Work continued constructing fire lines around a 56 mile perimeter. The DNR was supplying equipment and operators, and BFC was providing ground crew manpower. The fire continued to grow and the drought deepened. Total manpower rises above 1,000, 22 agencies assisted with fire crews being brought from 29 states. And at this point, we're starting burnout operations to burn fuel away from the lines towards the main fire. And as we talked about just a minute ago, the fire showed for the first time that it could come alive and reburn over previously burned marsh vegetation and organic soils as the drought continued unabated. It was contained with ground units and water drops. Command was merged into a joint state-federal structure with co-fire bosses Mike Paluta and Bob Weber. And we integrated the overhead teams, the firefighters, and the equipment on the lines. Here's an infrared scanner that was used for aerial scanning, looking for hotspots from a helicopter. August 29th, fire was at 30,850 acres. Suppression actions concentrated on line completion in preparation for burning out to the control lines. The southern point of the fire nearest state land is again contained. Lack of rainfall deepens drought to severe levels across the region, including not only Michigan, but Minnesota and the Dakotas and into Iowa and so forth. So it was not only Michigan, but it was the whole region. August 30th, fire was creeping in a northwest direction, size estimated at 38,500 acres. Containment was planned for the afternoon, but winds again caused a spotting over the lines. August 31st, fire is 40,000 acres in size. Our fire lines were well established and burned out except for the north and west flanks. Consultation with specialists and resource manager with the overhead teams resulted in the decision to burn out the entire north and west sides of the refuge to remove the fuel so it couldn't burn. Fire grows to 41,000 acres by September 1st. Continued mop-up was going on the south and east side, improving lines and preparing for the burnout when weather conditions were right. September 2nd, fire size grows to 41,965 acres. September 3rd, fire size grows to 49,000 acres. The southwest part of the burn is completed and the fire runs rapidly in the center towards M28, causing some concern that it could jump the road. Fortunately, it stopped. So the massive burnout operation of September 4th through the 6th, we burned out the complete northwest corner of the fire from the Creighton truck trail shown here, M28 on the north, Sini is in this direction to the east, and this is north here. So these massive burnout operations were conducted from a helicopter to consume the combustible fuels that were remaining inside the containment lines. Fire departments and equipment were on alert during the burnout. Several units were on standby on M28 for spot fires. September 5th, fire size is now 54,000 acres. Continued burnout operations were conducted along the Creighton truck trail on the west side and between the Soo Line railroad tracks and M28. September 6th, weather and humidity permitted burning as planned. A major effort was made to complete planned burnout using both ground and aerial ignition. The acreage grows to 64,000 acres. September 6th, the fire was declared contained with a loss of 64,000 acres, the largest in Michigan since 1908. All but 10,000 acres is inside the refuge. A simple definition of contained is the spread of the fire is stopped with a line. That doesn't mean the fire is out. Demobilization began with federal manpower reduced to 250 staff, and the state efforts were cut by about half. The fire base was shifted to a new camp at Star Siding on the north side of M28, about 5 miles east of Shingleton. September 8th to the 11th, the fire and on the north and northeast sides was still quite hot, but no spots were outside the line. Mop-up was in full progress with 330 firefighters. Crew demobilization continues. The fire is declared controlled, meaning that there's no further danger of spread, and the overhead team returned to Boise. On September 12th, 48 years ago today, fanned by high south winds and encouraged by very low humidity, the smoldering fire in the swamp comes alive, races over previously burned ground, forms a towering convection column. Firebrands are borne high into the air and blown north across M28, igniting two new fires. One is quickly contained at 350 acres. Anybody that travels a scenic stretch, there isn't very many structures, but it was right near the little telephone company building that's some kind of a junction station there. And it started a half a mile north of M28, the larger fire, and it made a 7 mile run overnight northward on a 2 mile front, engulfing more than 5,000 acres, and it burned into the early morning. It was very low humidity all night, abnormally low. On September 13th, the fire expanded to the east and it was now 8,400 acres in size. The fire was again declared major by the Boise Interagency Fire Center, and a general headquarters team commanded by Bob Sellers for the feds and the state fire supervisor, Robert Campo, as co-commanders to provide overall coordination between the two zones. Using M28 as the dividing line, the new North Zone has Paluta as fire boss, and the old Seney Refuge Zone has Mitch Wiles, reliefer Weber, as a fire boss for the South Zone. There is a rapid remobilization of federal and state forces, building back up to a former number of over 1,000 housed in the Star Siding Camp. Aerial water dropping capability was recalled and beefed up with fixed wing PBYs and DC-4s and helicopters with buckets. There's an air attack boss in charge of the entire Air Force. Large helicopters were brought in from Fort Sill, Oklahoma, Chinook and Skycrane here that could haul 3,000 gallons per load. 15th of September, Mike Paluta orders a direct attack on the North Zone, with 32 miles of line to be built around the immediate fire edge to keep the fire in place and prevent a further spread. Starting on the 16th, direct attack is mounted with much of the line constructed by hand in extremely difficult marsh and bog terrain. September 18th, intense burning conditions again, warm, low humidity, moderate winds causes the fire to become active and spread. And it puts intense pressure on the east flank of the North Zone, but is held within the lines thanks to aerial water and retardant drops. So, if the Seney fire wasn't enough problems, a new fire, apparently set by an arsonist, breaks out 15 miles to the southwest on the Hiawatha National Forest and crowns into mature jackpine. Personnel and equipment are diverted from the Seney fire, and the Jackpine Lodge fire is contained overnight with a loss of 300 acres. And through the retardant aircraft that were available, we were able to keep it from getting to the facilities there at Jackpine Lodge. That fire then was taken over by the Hiawatha National Forest, and they eventually had several DNR tractor plows and five DC-4 bombers working on the fire to keep it suppressed. September 21st, the fire is contained. A mop and mop up begins. So we have a loss of 8,500 acres in the North Zone, making the total loss for the fire at 72,500 acres. That's 112 square miles with 88 miles of control line. The fire created a mosaic pattern of burned and unburned areas that created abundant edge habitat for animals where they could browse on new tender shoots or feed on berries and seeds. and using the adjacent unburned areas as cover. Because the 76 fire didn't burn a continuous block, most wildlife found refuge in many of the scattered areas not touched by the fire. A large research project followed for the next several years, and they found that the number of species increased after the fire. There's details in the book if you want to read about that. The overall effect of the fire was to create greater diversity of wildlife habitat through setting back natural succession. Drought severity in October is as extreme as it can get for the Upper Peninsula and the northern parts of Minnesota, Wisconsin, and the Dakotas. The fire was abandoned when the snows came. So we got contained and controlled as the terms we normally use, but they couldn't do anything when the snow was on the ground. So it was abandoned. And the fire continued burning underneath the snowpack. It was declared controlled during the wintertime sometime. Expert opinion was divided on whether the fire would be extinguished by the heavy snowfall or would it still be burning in the spring. Organic peat and muck soils were smoldering as deep as 8 feet underground, but the snow did extinguish the fire during the ensuing winter of 77. Final cost estimates were over $8 million. That's $43 million adjusted for inflation. Over $1 million cost to the state, plus approximately $200,000 in timber damage and $76. The federal government reimbursed the state of Michigan by early the following June with $919,000 plus paid to the state's general fund by the Department of Interior through the assistance of Representative Phil Rupi's efforts to help get that reimbursement. Thanks for watching. So I have no more slides, but we'll throw it open to questions at this point.
Wow, that was, I just want to say, Greg, you know, I read the book. I mean, like I said, I'm just a few pages to go, but I thought the pictures in the book were great, but your slideshow was even better, much better. I mean, it was like, you really saw a lot. So very, very fascinating stuff. I know we've got quite a few people on the call. Does anyone have a question tonight?
I have some comments and questions. Shelley, go ahead.
You say several times, and I remember reading it also in the book, about how they were protecting the fire from going on to state land. And I'm just curious about, is there something special about state land?
Well, it's you and your neighbor. You got a fire on your side of the line, and I don't want it coming on my side of the line. Okay. It's pretty much as simple as that. The refuge at that point in time had no fire management staff to assist them in the science of fire, to assist them in showing them and telling them how dry it was, how much of a danger it posed to not only their lands, but to the neighbor's land, not only state, but private lands that were adjacent to the fire. Cleveland Cliffs lost $400,000 worth of timber when it went over on the north side of the M28. So the land to the south of the Manistique River State Forest, the state, if that fire had occurred on our side of the line, it would have been aggressively attacked and fought on day one. But because of a mistaken interpretation on my opinion, by the refuge manager, he decided to not attack it aggressively or allow the state to attack it aggressively, which may have brought a different outcome, a smaller fire.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Got more hands up. How about Michael looking in?
Okay.
Hello, Michael.
Hello, Greg. My question is, I heard you say that the peat went down 8 feet. Did the fire actually burn down to the bottom of the peat? And if so, I can't imagine that M28 was filled with sand 8 feet down. Was there a possibility that the fire could actually go under the road?
There was a possibility that it could have gone under the road, yes, but I don't know about the road construction itself, but I have to believe that they excavated out everything they needed to make that road on solid rock base, sand base, whatever. I don't think it could have, now I'm thinking about it, probably wouldn't have gone under the road because that would have been not made on organic soil. But they're underneath the, let's go back to the fire line itself. The fire lines in many places, the organic soil, even though they thought they might have been okay, there could have still been a thread of organic soil or a root that was dried out or whatever. A lot of times we'd find the roots actually burning like a dynamite fuse underneath the lines. So really no line was totally secure. We had to be continually vigilant, patrolling back and forth to make sure that the fire hadn't popped up again. And yes, the fire, the peat was as deep as 8 to 10 feet deep, not in every place, but in many places in the fire area.
We've got more questions here. So I see Mary's hand up. You want to go ahead, Mary?
My husband, the former forester, has a question.
No, you pretty much answered it. I was just concerned about the fire line construction, knowing that the peat was so deep. But you answered it, saying that they needed to be vigilant and continue to monitor the lines, because you know you just can't build fire line in that deep, and there must have been peat underneath some of that fire line, as well as you say the roots. But even a dozer, or a dozer with the fire plow or whatever, you could have potentially, though, too, maybe they were finding line that was more in the timber that was maybe outside the peat. Anyway, you pretty much answered the question when you said.
So, sounds like you've had an opportunity to put out fire in organic fuels before.
Yeah, I worked I was with the U.S. Forest Service, and I was 19 years on the Huron Manistee. And so I've been on a lot of fire line, but not in peat, mostly in jack pine.
Mostly in jack pine. I was in Mayo and Roscommon, and I had opportunity to swat on crowning jack pine fires myself. So appreciate that.
Yep. In the spring, they would have them out in the forest on fire standby because the fires could come up so quick and the winds could shift and change so fast that a fire could go from 5 acres to 50 in no time in the jack pine, because it loves to burn.
Well, the Mack Lake fire in 1980 or so burned 40,000 acres in one afternoon. So,
I was there after the Mack Lake, but that Mack Lake fire was responsible for the Forest Service, to really take another look at their prescriptions, burning prescriptions. It created a much more intense fire planning.
Yep, absolutely.
It was a sad situation there.
It was the last time there was a loss of life on a wildfire in Michigan.
And construction. In your fire line construction, that what we always keep in mind was anchor, anchor, anchor.
To an unburnable object. To an unburnable object, a road, rock, lake, stream, etc. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yep, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. I know Jan had a question, and then Julie after Jan.
Well, I had a couple things I wanted to ask. First of all, I went downstate last week, and on my way back, I made a point of stopping at Sini, which was Tuesday. And they have a temporary visitor center, and your book is not in there. Why is it not in there with the others? Do you have
they
any
know about
idea?
It. They know about it.
I just wonder if I could somehow do something to help you with that, because I just couldn't believe that they wouldn't be selling it in there. So I just wanted to mention that.
Yeah, I don't know what to tell you.
Okay.
I'll just offer this. It's at the Erickson Center in Curtis, so they could get it there if they wanted it.
Okay. Okay. And then I was curious, in the book you talked about arsonists different times, and I was surprised at how many there are. I know there's arson, obviously, but did they ever catch any of these people that you mentioned in your book? I mean, are you aware that any of these people catch it?
It would be the subject of another book, but yes. And
okay. I was hoping so. Yeah.
Yeah. But okay. Most often, no. I would say probably the majority escape without any without getting caught.
I have a question related to that.
Go ahead.
I was wondering if related to the arsonists, I had read that during the Depression, a lot of fires were set to so that people would be able to get jobs putting the fires out. Now, I don't know how extensive that was, but I wonder if during that time that was a problem too in the 70s.
Well, it happened on the Seney fire, I can guarantee you. I know it for a fact. So yeah, it was definitely a source of employment, and
gotcha.
That still occurs in other places in the nation.
Yeah.
It's actually a kind of a cultural thing. Like Tennessee, Kentucky, whatever, they just want to burn those hills in the springtime, and they do it. Their grandpappies did it and before them. So, but then there's just the people that for employment purposes, for the definite pyromaniac, which I won't go into the psychology of that, but there's some people that are mentally disturbed that do it. If you've been watching the TV lately about the folks that have been caught in California. So yeah, there's a number of reasons why people intentionally start fires.
Julie here has a question, and then we've got a few more hands, I see.
Okay.
Hi, my question is, I was amazed at how quickly, once the federal government got involved, how things happened. Now, was that, it talked about how the federal, state, all of the organizations worked together, but was it bringing in the federal government that really brought about the massive amount of equipment and people? I don't know. I'm just curious about how this all came so quickly to be very well structured and to tackle this incredibly fast fire.
When you start out with any fire, if it's a match dropped under the grass, if you can stamp it out with your foot, anybody can put it out. But when the fire gets to be 1,800 to 2,000 acres in size when you make initial attack, especially in a drought situation like it was, it's extremely difficult to make initial attack with any kind of equipment or people to contain the fire and then control it and then to physically put it out. I would say if the DNR had been allowed to have access, we had some equipment and we could have gotten equipment that can traverse wet ground. There's bulldozers that we got that had 36-inch wide pads on them, light 350s that were used for blueberry farming and so forth, like the cranberry farming down in Wisconsin. We could have gotten our hands on those. There was other pieces of equipment that we had that, and I'll just say that bringing in of the overhead team helped, I think it was a combination of the staff and equipment that was there that the DNR had already on scene, and as well as the staff that was brought in from fire crews from out of the state or from forests that were already in Michigan or Wisconsin. So I wouldn't say it was because of the overhead team being brought in that solved the problem. It was maybe a lot of things coming together at one time that had to happen in order to put that fire out.
Thank you. Thank you. Is there a Zeke? Do you have a question? I see a hand there.
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
Well, so first I'll say that
I credit the Sini fire for getting my first job with the Michigan DNR. I actually was driving through the smoke late September to go for an interview in Marquette. And I found that when I was there, the person competing against me for the job came in blackened with smoke. He had come off the fire line to compete for the job. And I think I had a real advantage being refreshed and ready for the interview. So that's my anecdote about the Sini fire. I was too young to actually have been on the fire. I do have a question for Greg. I remember working with folks in Minnesota on fires there, and they talked about a fire manager from Minnesota, and I don't know if it was Superior National Forest or the Minnesota DNR, who talked about periodicity of these drought-based fires. And he mentioned a 30-year period between fires. And I thought it was interesting that, you know, the Sleeper Lake fire of 2007 occurred 31 years after the Sini fire in 1976. Do you recall who that might have been? Did you do any of your own thinking about this notion that there's this periodicity to drought and the possibility that those really severe droughts might not occur every year or every few years, but maybe takes sometimes decades to recur?
You're right on target there, Zeke. And for just full disclosure here, Zeke was a fire management specialist with the DNR in Marquette, and we worked together for many years. And he's the guy with the big brain, I'll tell you right now. And so if he's talking about periodicity of drought, he's already done his homework. He knows the answer already. But I'll entertain that with saying that I am positive that there is a cycle. Whether it's 30 years or 60 years, I don't know, but I'm certain that there is. And that one slide that I had back towards the beginning of the research that the refuge did of the landscape fires, those were certainly during late summer droughts. And I don't remember the period between, but there was some 40 to 60 year period. So I think you're right on target there, that there is a cycle to it. And it might be getting shortened up during the where we're at right now. Matter of fact, if the summer had been a little different, we might be right into those Sini fire conditions this year. But it takes a lot of things to happen for a bad drought like that to occur. So thanks for the question, Zeke. Good hearing from you.
Yeah. And thanks for the book, Greg. It's a history that I will remember. Thank you.
Okay. And I think Michael's got his hand up, and then Nina.
Yes. Hello. I'm double dipping, so if there's someone else who hasn't had a chance to speak, please go ahead.
Go ahead, Michael. Go ahead.
Okay. You mentioned that there was an increase in biodiversity after the fire. What sort of trees were there before? What sort of foliage and trees were there before the fire, and what showed up after the fire?
Oh, boy. I would have to open the book up and read you chapter and verse, but I'm going to just say this, that short-lived species like birch tend to come up after fires. Most of what burned was swamp, and you would expect swamp species to come up. In my fire modeling, I used spruce and fir, basically. So I don't know that they're particularly long-lived. There wasn't that much hardwood that was burned in the swamp itself, but I can tell you this 47 years later, that it's probably pretty close to what it was then as far as the vegetation goes. But it did create, like I said in the slides, the edge and the setback on succession helped the wildlife immeasurably to it didn't create so much diversity as it increased habitat for maybe some different species that occupied niches that weren't available before. There were species that came in. I can't remember the exact, there was bird species. There was no fish species that were harmed that I recall. There was some amphibian species were displaced. As far as large species, bear, deer, et cetera, they moved out of the way and came back in afterwards. Matter of fact, on the north end of the fire, I know deer hunters that came in there. There was a lot of grasses that came up in that north fire, north of 28, and they were hunting and getting a lot of good deer hunting in right on that green grass that came up after the fire with the fall rains that came. And so they did pretty well in October and November on some of that area.
Okay. Well, thank you. Nina, I said you were, did that answer your question, Michael?
Yes, thank you.
Good. Okay, Nina, you've got a question and then Horst.
Okay, just quick, because I've already talked before too, or asked questions. This was just a fascinating discussion. I wanted to mention about the fire north of Newberry. They call it the sleeper fire. I'm from Newberry, so that's why. And my father was a logger. But I wondered what you thought about the response was to the sleeper fire happening in 2007, the difference. I think it was a smaller fire than the one you're talking about, the Seney fire, because I don't know that there were 1,000 people that had to be fed and taken care of, which the logistics of that that's amazing in itself, out in the middle of the swamp where there's nothing really, you know?
Right.
So that, but I was wondering how you felt if you felt that that experience helped the response in the sleeper fire. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the question. And I've got to admit some degree of ignorance because I retired from the state in 97 and the Sleeper Lake fire was in the 2000s. So I would be speaking third hand about it. I know that it was a rapid moving fire that burned a lot of jack pine. I believe it went all the way to Lake Superior, if I'm not mistaken. And it did take hundreds of people, not thousands, but it did take hundreds of people and a lot of pieces of equipment and aircraft to put it out, to contain it and control it. I could talk about it if I had a little bit of chance to do some research, but I'd probably get a fellow by the name of Richard Onan, who was the incident commander on that fire, put him in this chair here and have him talk about it. He would have a long story.
All right, thank you. Horst, your turn.
Thank you. I got two questions for you. One is, what was the reasoning by the superintendent of Saney for pulling out the DNR firefighters initially? And then the other thing, I noticed the clothes that the firefighters are working, it seems like they're much less protected than they are in today's firefighting world.
So in regard to what the refuge manager was thinking about, I can't speak for him, but I believe he was very concerned with the status of the wilderness area that he was managing, and that by congressional mandate, no equipment was to be brought in there. That was his opinion. That is, of course, not exactly the case today. And I'm going to just step ahead 47 years and say that they have an excellent fire staff at the refuge now. They're equipped with a lot of specialized pieces of equipment to attack those kind of fires now. Things have changed and improved very, very much over the years. But what he may have been thinking was about that wilderness area, and it was overpowering to him that he thought, it's not that bad, it's just in the swamp. He didn't realize how dry it was, even though we were waving red flags in front of him, that we were capable and equipped to go in there and to keep the fire a lot smaller than it ended up being at initial attack. It would have still been a chore, but it wouldn't have been a huge project. So I guess I'd just say that, you know, that's the only thing I can probably add to that. And in regard to safety, all of the people that were on that fire were equipped with hard hat, Nomex. I don't believe that they had fire shelters at that time. I'm trying to remember where the breakpoint was. I think we got those a few years later, the aluminum tents that if a person is in a has made a grave error and is in being run down by a fire, you can pop one of these shelters and get in it, and you may or may not survive, but better a chance than not having it. I should add that in regard to any problems with safety that we had on the fire, there was probably the paramedics that were on scene did a superior job. They rotated in and out for a couple weeks shift at a time. They must have treated hundreds and hundreds of cases of URI and colds, people having to sleep on the ground and sleep in their tents or something. We didn't have places for everybody to sleep in a motel. So there was that going on. There was a lot of scrapes. There might have been a few broken fingers here and there, scrapes and so forth. But the most serious thing that happened on the fire that I recall was a young firefighter had to be medevaced off the fire line to the Munising Hospital to have his appendix removed. So that was probably the worst thing I remember happening. So the safety record on the fire, whether it was through good management or luck or accommodation, we did pretty well by our record.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Greg. I don't know if we have anybody else, any other final questions or comments? I just, we got one from Sue. Okay, Sue, take it away.
Hello.
I can't let Greg leave without telling him how much I enjoyed this book. Oh my goodness, and I write fiction and read fiction, but it was fabulous. And I was particularly impressed with the heroics of doing something like this and on the book in the book world of how you organized it. It was so interesting to step through from ancient history of the geology of it and into the human part and then into the fires plus the day broken day by day. And I did all the charts in the back and then went through all the names to see the people that I knew that were in
that oh, had okay, that's
there
cool.
Because I knew some of them. I remember when that fire happened, I was in Pickford a few miles to the east. But thank you so much. This presentation has been great and the book is fabulous.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Yep. Thank you, Greg. It was a very good book. Oh, one more from Mary. Final comment, Mary.
What do we got?
I was really impressed with all of the scientific facts and charts. Having gone to forestry school and taken at least one class in fire behavior, it was just kind of brought me back, and I was really impressed with all the science.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Greg. I think we all really enjoyed our talk tonight on the Great Saney Fire. Saney Fire. And if you haven't read the book, I really do highly recommend it. It was excellent. And it'll make a lot more sense to you now that you've talked to Greg, too, with the day-by-day BAB. So that was really good. Mm-hmm. And we hope to see you all back in October as we discuss a nostalgic lens, which is photographs and essays from the Michigan's Upper Peninsula. So thank you, everyone. Thank you, Victor. And thank you very much, Greg. Everybody have a good night. Mm-hmm.
You've been watching the UP Notable Books Club, brought to you by the Upper Peninsula Publisher and Authors Association. To join or for more information, please visit us at www.upa.org or www.upnotable.com.